The book of Daniel provides us with some fascinating insights into prophecy, both fulfilled prophecy and for prophecy that is yet to come. Some of the prophecies are hundreds of years, some of the prophecies in Daniel are hundreds of years before Christ is born as a human being, and they span the time up to the return of Jesus Christ, some even into the millennium. And today in this sermon, the second in this series on prophecy, we're going to introduce the book of Daniel, and we're going to look at one of Daniel's prophetic chapters, which is chapter 2. Now, Daniel is a book that is very hard for scholars to accept, because Daniel is a very specific book. It deals about kingdoms, it names names, it talks about Alexander the Great, it talks about various other kings, and it gives very, very specific details, especially Daniel chapter 11 and 12. And so some of the scholars who have read the book of Daniel say, oh, this book cannot be what it claims to be, which is a prophetic book. In other words, a book written before the events happen. This book has to have been written after the events happened because they're so precise. So many of your modern scholars believe that there was a, what they call a pseudo-Daniel, who wrote after the events had occurred and put his name on it and claimed that it was written before they occurred. And we know that that's not correct because of various other things. Now, if you look in the scriptures, there are many places where Jesus Christ talks about what Daniel says in his book. And Jesus Christ accepted Daniel's book as being authentic. So if it was good enough for Christ to accept, I think that that is good enough for me. Now, the book was written in various sections, some in Aramaic, most of it in Hebrew, from around 600 BC, and it was completed about 539 BC. So we've got a span of about 59 to 60 years it was written. Now, if you remember Daniel, if you go to Daniel chapter 1, let's get a little background on Daniel, since he's the one that wrote the book. And he's the author of it and the events that occurred in his life. Let's look a little bit about Daniel's life, especially about how he got into Babylon or how he became who he was in Babylon. Now, in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So Nebuchadnezzar himself didn't come, but he sent his generals. And you can read about that in some of the prophets. And the generals besieged Jerusalem, and there was two reasons that Jerusalem and Judea went into captivity. Two laws they broke. One was Sabbath breaking. They didn't keep the Sabbath. And the other was idolatry. They were in all kinds of idolatrous forms of worship, Astarte worship and various other kinds of worship. So Jerusalem and Judea, Jerusalem is in Judea, the area of Judea, was besieged by Nebuchadnezzar's army. And after a certain amount of time, the city fell. And you can read about that in the various books in the Kings and Chronicles and various other places. And in verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. I want you to notice that. The Lord allowed Judah's king to be taken by Nebuchadnezzar. It was part of God's plan because God needed to bring judgment onto Judah. Now, if you read some of the background to it, there's places where Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, and the general that's besieging the city says, Nebuchadnezzar has been appointed by God to take over and destroy the city. I'm paraphrasing. And he was correct. God had told Nebuchadnezzar, I want you to go to Babylon. You're going to be my instrument of wrath on Jerusalem, and you're going to take over the city. So somehow or another, we're not sure exactly, Nebuchadnezzar was told by God and sent by God, his general, to take over Judah and Jerusalem and to besiege the city. And verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the houses of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. You remember in one of the chapters later, we have Belteshazzar, and Belteshazzar's taking the cups that are in storage, that were from God's house, and he's drinking, toasting the gods, the false gods. They were having a good old knockdown, drag-out orgy. That's what they were having. And they were drinking while they were doing this. So while they were having all of these orgies, they were taking these golden cups, filling them with wine, and toasting the false gods. You remember the handwriting on the wall? And then we had the Median king come and destroy Babylon and take it over. Darius and came, destroyed the city, took it over. And you remember about Daniel in the lion's den? And Darius, and you know, Darius was afraid that Daniel had gotten eaten and all of that. Obviously, if you prophesy that the city is going to be destroyed, the person that destroys the city is going to look onto you with a lot of favor. And so Darius, the new king, says, so you're the man that prophesied that I was going to destroy the city, huh? Well, he made him second in command in his city, as you can read in many places. Now, verse 3, the king instructed the master of his eunuchs to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. So Daniel was either a noble person, a descendant of the king, or one of the young people that had been taken captive. If you look at the chronology of Daniel and how old Daniel seems to be at the very end and how long he'd been in Babylon, Daniel was probably about 16, 17 years old when he came into Babylon. So he was a young person. He was a teenager. A lot of times teenagers say, oh, what can I do? I mean, this is my, you know, I'm not an adult. What can I do? Well, Daniel's country had been destroyed. He may have seen his parents and his relatives killed. The king was taken into captivity. His nation was destroyed. And here's Daniel, a young person in a foreign country. You remember the story about his three friends. They had Babylonian, they had Jewish names, but they gave them Babylonian names. We know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And there's a whole chapter devoted to how they wouldn't bow down to the great image that King Nebuchadnezzar had made. Verse 4, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve at the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. So the Babylonians would take their conquered subjects and they would move them out of the area they were in and they would bring them and put them in another area. So what happened when Jerusalem was besieged and taken? They took all the inhabitants, the ones they didn't kill, and they took them back to Babylon and they filled that area with other people. So the people that were living in Babylon, in Jerusalem, were taken to Babylon. And out of these people, the king picked out good-looking, intelligent, quick-witted, sharp young people. That was what Daniel was. He was one of those. Verse 5. They were going to teach him the way of the Chaldeans. Now, if you were a Chaldean king or a Babylonian king, and you had an area to govern, and that area was the area of Judah and Jerusalem, and you could train people and then send them back, they would go back with an attitude of being the servants of the Chaldeans, ministering in the country they were sent back to. So that's what happened lots of times. They were sent back to be governors and various other officials. Verse 5, and the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and the wine which he drank. They were going to be in school for 3 years. So 3 years, we're going to feed you, clothe you, teach you, and house you. And at the end of that time, verse 5, last part, they might serve before the king. So at the end of the 3 years, Daniel, who was going to be fed, housed, and clothed, was going to stand before the king. And the king was going to interview them and see which ones were the creme de la creme. Now from among those sons of Judah were Daniel and his three companions. Shows in verse 7 the Babylonian names they give them. But Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine they drank. Therefore he told the eunuch, look, this food you're giving us, either it's not good nutritionally, or something's wrong with it spiritually, or maybe it's unclean, but it's not good for me to eat this. So I'm not going to eat this. Well, the eunuch says to him, well, hold on there a minute. My job is to make sure that you become healthy are healthier, to train you and to make you acceptable to the king when he interviews you. And if you go in there looking like you haven't eaten, or you're malnourished, or there's something wrong, you're talking about my head. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel says to him, "You know what? Why don't you just give us a vegetarian diet? Let us eat some vegetables. And see what we look like. Vegetables and water." And they ate vegetables and they drank water. And it says that they looked healthier than their companions. Now you have to consider something here. Daniel had some companions, the nobles that had been raised with him and his friends, who, hey, let's not make waves. We're in a strange land. These people have taken our country captive. They've killed everyone. They've taken the king captive. He's in jail right now. Who are you and I to say that we shouldn't be eating this king's food? I don't want to make any waves. They put it before me, I'm going to eat it. And Daniel was not like that. So Daniel showed some resolve. Verse 12, it says to test them, appearance. So he consented in verse 14. And they were healthier and better looking than all the rest in verse 15. And so they are presented before the king. I'm paraphrasing the rest of the chapter. They're presented before the king. And the king makes them very important officials in the kingdom. So Nebuchadnezzar was very impressed with Daniel and with his three friends. And the point of all of this is that even though Daniel was in a very difficult position, he kept God's laws and he kept God's ways. Now, that brings us to Daniel chapter 2. Now, if Daniel was around 16 or 17 when chapter 1 takes place, and he's there when Darius the Mede is king of Babylon, we're talking of about 60 or 70 years. So Daniel was around 72, 78 years old in the ending of the book of Daniel. He'd been there all his life. So he was there as a young man, and at the end of the book of Daniel, he's a very, very old man, but very, very righteous. Now, we're going to look in this sermon, we're going to look at the prophecy in Daniel chapter 2. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled so that his sleep left him. He was suffering from bad dreams, insomnia. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dream. So they came and they stood before the king. So I have all these magicians, sorcerers, astrologers, and they're there before the king. And the king says, "I've dreamed a dream. I want you to interpret it." And they go, "Very good, sir. Tell us what you've dreamed and we'll tell you what it means." Verse 3, "And the king said to them, 'I have had a dream and my spirit is anxious to know the dream.'" Now, sometimes when you and I dream, we don't remember our dream. There's probably hundreds of dreams, thousands that you and I have dreamed that we don't even remember we've dreamed. Scientists say that if you want to remember a dream, you have to wake up while it's going on. That's why when you wake up, you think, "I've been having dreams." If you sleep soundly through the night, it's buried in your subconscious. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar dreamed a dream, and either he had forgotten what the dream was, or he didn't want to tell the wise men what the dream was. It doesn't say in the Bible which one of those it was. But oftentimes, you know, I've been sitting at the dining room table eating something, and I'll be thinking, "Oh, wait a minute, I dreamed this specific thing a few days ago, and it involved this, and it involved that, and yeah, I remember, it's coming back to me." And sometimes we dream dreams, and we have a little smidgen of what it's about, but we don't know exactly what it's about. Maybe that's what King Nebuchadnezzar had done. He had a dream, and it had left his memory. Or maybe he had the dream and he knew exactly what it was, but he was using this to test the Chaldeans and the wise men. We don't know. Verse 4, "Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, 'O king, live forever. Tell your servants a dream, and we'll tell you what it means. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretations, so this is what the king said, look, not only do I want you to tell me what I dreamed, but I want you to tell me what it means. Huh? If you don't tell me all this, notice the last part of verse 5, you shall be cut in pieces, I'm going to make mincemeat out of you, and your houses shall be made into an ash heap, I'm going to burn your houses down. So you better tell me what I dreamed. So we got all these wise men who are being threatened with execution. All the leaders of the kingdom. However, if you tell me the dream and what it means, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me what I dreamed. Tell me what it means. They answered again and said, let the king, look, king, maybe you didn't understand us, but you just tell us what you dreamed, and we'll tell you what it means. Then they answered again and said, let the king tell the servants a dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time. You're stalling because you have seen that my decision is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed to speak lying words and corrupt words before me till I've changed my mind. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. I look at it this way, gentlemen. If you can tell me what I dreamed, you certainly can tell me what the interpretation is. It'll be correct. What happens when you tell the king no? The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, king, you're being unreasonable, paraphrasing. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of magicians, astrologers, or Chaldeans. It's a very difficult thing that the king requests. And there's nobody that can tell you what you dreamed except the gods. And they don't live with men. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious. They were telling the king, hey, we can't do this. And not only can't we not do this, you're being unreasonable for expecting us to do this. Very furious, verse 12, and he gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. This includes the scholars, the wise men, the nobles, includes Daniel, includes his three friends. They're all going to be rounded up and executed because the king is upset that his dream cannot be interpreted and they cannot tell him what it means. Verse 13, so the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch. He was the captain of the king's executioners, as it should read, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, what's going on? Why is this happening so fast? Why are all the wise men being rounded up to be killed? What's going on? Then Arioch, in verse 15, made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in. Now, I want you to think about something. He's going to go in verse 16, he's going in and he sees the king. Do you remember the story of Esther? You remember the story of Esther where you've got Haman and Mordecai tells her about the plot and all of that to kill all the Jews? And Esther lives in the palace for the queen, and the king lives in a royal palace. And you just didn't walk in and go see the king. You had to be summoned to go see the king. And if you walked in to the king's presence, if he didn't hold out the sepulcher to you, you touched the sepulcher. If he didn't do that, you were led away to be executed. So you remember what Esther said? She said, well, I'm going to go in and see the king in 3 days. You fast. And if I die, well, I die. If he doesn't want to see me, it's my death. Same thing for the Babylonian kings. Daniel goes in to see the king. The king didn't call Daniel. So what does that mean about the king and Daniel's relationship? The king thought a lot about Daniel because he didn't make Daniel die. He didn't execute him. Verse 16. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. You know, he wouldn't give all of the wise men and all of the other men, astrologers, soothsayers, he wouldn't give them the time of day. But Daniel says, if you'll just give me a little time, I will answer the king's request. The king was so respectful of Daniel that not only when Daniel walked in, but when Daniel asked for time, the king said, all right, I'll do that. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to his three companions. Verse 18, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then in a night vision, Daniel was given the answer about the dream. So now Daniel knows what the dream is that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, and he knows what it means. Now, verse 20 is a very good lesson for us. Daniel answers that, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He made Nebuchadnezzar the king that was going to invade and take Jerusalem captive. He raised him up. And we're so, you know, we live in a very political world, brethren. And one of the things in this world is politics. Oh, who's going to get elected? Who's not going to get elected? Why is she going to be better? Why is he going to be better? What's going to happen if they get elected? Let me tell you something. God puts into positions of power who he wants in those positions of power, because certain things have to happen. He removes kings in verse 21 and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you. When's the last time you prayed and your prayer was answered? Did you thank God for the answered prayer? Right here, the first thing Daniel does is thanks God that the prayer has been answered. A lesson for us. And you have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Verse 24, a little bit of human nature right here. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said to him, there's no need to kill everybody. I know what the king dreamed, and I know what it means. Now notice what Arioch says in verse 25, a little insight into human nature. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, I have found a man. You know, I'm so wise, king, that I scoured the kingdom and I found this man that can answer your question. I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. He didn't say, this man has come to me and wants to interpret your dream. Then the king answered to Daniel. He said, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Notice Daniel did not say the following. Look, King Nebuchadnezzar, I'm from a long lineage of God-fearing people. And I am wise and understanding. And because I'm so close to God, God has answered my prayer. And I'm going to be able to help you now. He didn't say that. Notice what he said. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded that all the other people could not answer, could not declare to the king. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. So Daniel says, you know what? It's not because I'm a great person. It's not because I'm so smart. It's because God wants you to know what's going to happen. And I'm simply here to tell you what God has sent me to tell you. So there was two parts to the request of Nebuchadnezzar. The first part, what did I dream? The second part, what does this dream mean? So we're going to look at the first part, which is, what did the king dream? Either he forgot or he was withholding the information. As for you, O king, verse 29, thoughts came into your mind while you were on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret was not revealed to me because I have more wisdom than any living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts on your heart. He begins to tell the king what he dreamed. He says in verse 31, you, O king, were watching, and behold, there was a great image. A great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. So in your dream, you saw this large statue, large image. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Now, before we go any further, let's think about this. We go with the golden head, silver arms and chest, brass midsection, iron legs. As we go from top to bottom, or as history progresses, the metals become less expensive. Gold, then you have silver. Silver is not as expensive as gold. Then you have brass. Brass is not as expensive as silver. Then you have iron. Iron is not as expensive as brass. So as we go from the head down to the bottom, the quality of the metal is less. But the strength of the metal is more. Gold is very soft. Silver, brass, iron. So as we go down, the metals get stronger. And this is what's happened to the kings and the nations of the world. We tend to think it's the other way around, but actually ancient kingdoms were very, very knowledgeable about many things. All right, now, verse 33, his legs of iron. How many parts were there of iron? How many pieces? There were two, because there's a right leg and there's a left leg. Its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. The feet were one on each leg. And then it's going to talk about the toes later on. How many toes do you have on each leg? Five. You don't have an image that has four toes on one leg and six toes on the other, or three and seven, or nine and one. You have five toes on each leg. Now, if the legs represent something, which they do, then the toes represent something from that leg. Everybody with me? So bear that in mind. Some of the things we're going to need to consider before we look at what the dream meant. Verse 34. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands. This was a supernatural stone. It wasn't a human stone. Without hands, which struck the image on its what? On its feet. The image did not get struck by the rock on its head. The rock didn't hit the head. The rock didn't hit the stomach. The rock didn't hit the legs. The rock hit the toes, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay. So the feet were of iron and clay. Now, it wasn't iron and soft clay. It was iron and ceramic clay. And that kind of weakens the metal. Verse 34, you watch while a stone was cut out supernaturally without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, all these metals were chopped up into little pieces like sawdust and became like the chaff from the summer's threshing floor. The wind blew them away and they disappeared, till no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the feet became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Did the stone fill heaven? Did the stone fill some kind of spiritual realm? No, the stone filled the earth. This wasn't, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this was Christ coming and setting up a spiritual kingdom. No, it wasn't. This kingdom filled the earth. The kingdoms represented by all of these were physical earthly kingdoms. And so the stone, although it was supernatural, also fills the whole earth. What is a mountain? A mountain is a kingdom. Hosea, we'll go up to the mountain of the Lord. That was a dream, verse 36. This is the dream. So, King Nebuchadnezzar, you dreamed about this large image, golden head, arms of silver, midsection of brass, legs of iron. This stone came out of somewhere, supernaturally, cut without hands, and it hits the feet that are part of iron and part of clay. And this image tumps over, breaks into pieces, the wind comes and blows it all away, and that stone becomes a great mountain that fills all the earth. That's what you dreamed. You can about now see Nebuchadnezzar with his mouth open. As Daniel is telling, either Nebuchadnezzar said, because he knew the dream, either Nebuchadnezzar said, whoa, he's telling me exactly what I dreamed. Or as Daniel's beginning to tell him the dream, Nebuchadnezzar is beginning to remember. It's all coming back to him. Verse 36, this is a dream. Now we will tell you what it means. I'm going to tell you what it means, king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you what? A kingdom, power, strength, and glory. How did Nebuchadnezzar get his kingdom? God gave it to him. Because God wanted Nebuchadnezzar to play some part in prophecy. Verse 38. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand. And you has he made ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. There's no interpretation required, brethren. You know who the head of gold was? Nebuchadnezzar. Because that's what Daniel says. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. Now after Nebuchadnezzar comes another kingdom. Hold your place there. And let's go to Daniel chapter 5. The handwriting on the wall. Notice verse 30. Belteshazzar is either the grandson or the co-ruler with Nebuchadnezzar. You remember where it says that Belteshazzar, the queen mother, told Belteshazzar, call Daniel and he can interpret what this writing means? And Belteshazzar said, if you interpret this dream for me, I'll make you the third ruler in the land. You know why he was the third ruler? Because Nebuchadnezzar was still alive. Belteshazzar was the second. The highest position he gave Daniel was the third. Notice verse 30. That very night, Belteshazzar, the king of Babylon, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So Darius the Mede. Now go back to Daniel chapter 2. Verse 38 is Nebuchadnezzar and the head of gold. Verse 39, what's the next king, world ruling kingdom? Conquered the Babylonians? The Medes, Darius the Medes, and the Persians. There was two parts to the kingdom. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to you. You know why there was, the image had the silver chest. You know why there was two arms? The Medes and the Persians. We can read about them in Daniel chapter 8 with the ram and the goat, which we're going to do later on. Verse 39, there's coming the Medo-Persian kingdom, inferior to yours. Why do we know that? Because silver is inferior to gold. And a third kingdom of bronze, which was the Greek kingdom. That's going to be talked about also in Daniel chapter 8. With the ram and the he-goat, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Who conquered the Greeks? The Romans. The Greeks used brass weapons. The Romans used iron weapons. Not only did they use iron weapons, but the Romans used iron that had been tempered. And so their weapons were very strong. Verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, insomuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. The Roman kingdom destroyed everything that stood in its way. Destroyed everything. Greatest war-making machine that ever existed was the Roman kingdom. Verse 41. Now, the Roman kingdom was the iron kingdom. The Iron Kingdom was represented by what? The two legs. Rome was divided historically into two divisions. You had the Western Division that had its capital at Rome, and you had the Eastern Division that had its capital at Constantinople. You remember Constantine? Constantinople was named after him, sometimes called the Byzantine Kingdom, but it was a Roman kingdom. So the Roman kingdom had two parts to it, the Western Kingdom and the Eastern Kingdom. Now, the toes are going to come out of the legs later on. Where are the five toes coming from? Part of them are going to come from the Western Kingdom, and part of them are going to come from the Eastern Kingdom. Because, once again, you don't have legs with six toes on one foot and four toes on the other. They each have five. Notice verse 41. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, this last kingdom of the toes shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay. So Europe and this area, the Western Europe and Eastern Europe, are made up of a bunch of different independent cultures. And the only thing that has united Europe before in the past has been religion. And so you're going to get all of these nations, some from the Western, some from the Eastern, and they're going to unite. And they're going to be partially strong and partially not strong, because we've got so many cultures trying to be mixed together. Verse 42, and as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. The clay was not soft clay. The clay was ceramic clay. Pottery. You know what happens to pottery when you hit it? It breaks. That's why it says it was very fragile in verse 42. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, which kings are we talking about? The kings represented by the feet. Not the king of the head and all that. What did the stone hit? In verse 34, stone without hands, it hits the feet. The stone does not hit the head of Babylon. The stone does not hit the Greek kingdom. The stone does not hit the Medo-Persian kingdom. The stone hits the toes that come out of the Roman kingdom. Verse 43. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of the feet, the iron and the clay kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. You remember the kingdoms being blown away by the wind? Brethren, there's going to come a time, a point in time, sometime in the future, when people are going to say, you mean to tell me there was really nations that were ruled by men? Because you're going to be 200 or 300 years into the millennium, and there's only going to be one kingdom. And there's going to be people born in that kingdom who have never known what you and I know. And they're going to look back and they're going to say, I can't believe that men ever ruled men. I mean, it hasn't always been this way. Verse 44, and in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Where is it going to stand? It's going to what? Fill the whole earth. It's not up in heaven, as the Protestants tell you. These are all literal, physical kingdoms. The Babylonian kingdom was on the earth. The Medo-Persian kingdom was on the earth. The Greek kingdom was on the earth. The Roman kingdom was on the earth. And the kingdom that conquers all of them is going to be on the earth. Verse 45. Insomuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain. There's another mountain, another kingdom this stone came from. Obviously referring to what? Christ as a forerunner. But Christ returns again. Christ did not return the first time as a king of kings. Christ returned the first time as a lamb. That's why the Jews did not recognize Christ, because they were waiting for Christ to return, as it says in the books of Isaiah and all these other places, where this Messiah is returning as a conquering hero. And he's in this, you know, Zechariah, you know, their tongue shall be destroyed in their mouth while they stand. And then everybody's going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. That's the Messiah they were waiting for. They weren't waiting for some Messiah to die as a lamb. So they didn't recognize him. You're not the true Messiah. You're supposed to establish this kingdom we've been reading about. So that kingdom is going to be established when Jesus Christ returns. Has Jesus Christ returned yet to establish a kingdom? Then that means that the feet are still standing, right? Are going to stand. Notice verse 45. Insomuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. Daniel had saved all of the wise men from being executed. The only reason there was wise men after this was because of Daniel. Notice verse 46. The king, then King Nebuchadnezzar, fell on his face. Prostrate on the ground. I mean, he's flat on the ground. The king doesn't bow to you. You bow to the king. And here was King Nebuchadnezzar, fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. You know, he's a god. We've got to make some offerings to him. This is God in the flesh. Then the king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is a God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. And then it talks about the king promoting Daniel. So Daniel not only told the king what the dream was, but he interpreted. So the interpretation of the dream was, there's going to be a Babylonian kingdom. After the Babylonian kingdom comes an inferior kingdom. After you, the Medes and the Persians, represented by the silver chest and the two arms. After you comes the Greek kingdom, represented by the midsection, the groin and the thighs and the stomach. You know, the same Greeks that ran their Olympics in the nude. What better part of the body to represent them? And then we have, like, the strongest part of the human body, the two legs of iron, representing the Roman kingdom. With a division in the west, with Rome as its capital, and a division in the east, with Constantinople as its capital. And then out of those two divisions are going to come some kings. Now, go to Daniel chapter 17. Go to Daniel chapter 17. I'm sorry, Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. Now in Revelation chapter 17, we have a woman riding a beast. And the beast has seven heads. And the seventh head has 10 horns. Verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. This is verse 12 of Revelation 17. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet. They haven't come to power yet. But they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. The beast is not ruling yet. So these kings have not come into existence yet. When the beast comes to power, there's going to be 10 kings that are going to be associated with him, that are going to be with him and be loyal to him for about an hour. Not very long. Verse 13, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. It talks about Jesus Christ returning in this verse. Has Jesus Christ returned the second time? No. So this vision of these 10 horns is for some time in the future. Now, interestingly, in verse 14, he's going to make war. These 10 kings are going to make war with the Lamb. Now, I want you to notice something in verse 12. In verse 12, the kings are contemporary kings. In other words, there's not one king and then another king and then another king. All 10 kings exist at the same time because they all are going to be given their loyalty to the beast for 1 hour at one time. And they're all at the same time going to be destroyed by Christ in verse 14. So these 10 horns exist at the same time. They're contemporaries. They live at the same time period. So these 10 kings have not come to power yet because Jesus Christ has not returned yet. Now go back to Daniel chapter 2. And in verse 34, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet, the toes, and broke them in pieces. Jesus Christ, when he returns, is going to destroy the image because he's going to strike down the 10 kings represented in Daniel 2 by the 10 toes and in Revelation 17 by the 10 horns. He hasn't done that yet. So that means the image is still around, still standing. Question. The world keeps holidays. You don't think these kingdoms still exist? The world keeps holidays. Where does Christmas come from? Babylon. Where does Easter, Astarte, come from? Babylon. Where does the false resurrection of Christ on Sunday come from? Babylon. We all watch the Olympics on television. Is there going to be the Olympics in the world tomorrow? No. The Olympics are Greek. They were run in the nude. They had offerings to their gods before they ran. Now, we've cleaned them all up and everything, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with watching them. But there's going to be athletic events in the millennium, but there's not going to be the Olympics. So what I'm getting at is this. In all different kinds of ways, Babylon, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Roman system are still with us today. We still live in that system. And those systems have not been destroyed yet. When we see the rise of the 10 toes, then we're going to see Christ returning soon after that, because it's only for a little hour that those kings exist. Now, if you look at Europe now, Europe has got two divisions to it. There's those that are from the western part, and there's those that are from the eastern part. And right now, the big thing is Great Britain going to stay in the European community? Well, out of this conglomeration of nations, maybe not this, but one in the future, is going to come the 5 toes for the Western system and the 5 toes for the Eastern system. And we can't be specific. Lots of times after prophecies occur, we all go, oh, yeah, I can see it now. But what I want you to understand is that there's coming a time when there's going to be 10 kings, and they're going to give their power and their loyalty to the beast who hasn't arisen yet. And that is going to be representative of the 10 toes. And that's the stone is going to come out of heaven, and that's going to strike those 10 toes, and it's going to destroy the nations that we know of today, and God's going to institute a new world order. That's what the book of Daniel chapter 2 shows us. Daniel chapter 2 occurs with the starting of the Babylonian kingdom, which is around 600 or 700 BC. And it ends up with sometime in the future when Jesus Christ is returning. So for at least 2.5 millennia, the book of Daniel chapter 2 incorporates all that time. So what we have to remember, brethren, is the book of Daniel is a very interesting book. The book of Daniel chapter 2 gives us an overview of prophecy. Later on in some of the other sermons, we're going to be covering in more detail some of these other prophecies.